I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
At universities in Argentina, no classes. Students and teachers are on strike.
Classes are empty, but the halls are busy with activity.
The latest protests against Argentine President Javier Milei. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Meanwhile, students in Haiti are desperate to get back into school.
They and their parents have been forced out of their homes. Many of them are living in encampments. Some of those encampments are on the grounds of schools.
In China, an unexpected economic stimulus package takes aim at real estate woes.
There are knock-on effects from the property sector, which is the question of local government debt.
And don't mess with dachshund owners in Germany.
I was never into politics, okay? But when I see what they do right now, they should better shut up.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. A war on multiple fronts is emerging in the Middle East, with Israel at the center of it. A few updates for you as we begin the show today.
First, in the aftermath of Iran firing nearly 200 missiles at Israel, the Netanyahu government today released a highly produced video demanding that the world take action.
Iran must be crushed with crippling sanctions. Its revolutionary guards must be declared terrorists. Iran attacked. Israel will hit back to defend its people.
The U.S., Israel's staunch ally, provided military support to defend Israel during last night's attacks. President Biden says he's discussing with Israel how best to respond to Iran. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian says his country is not looking for war. But he pledged an even stronger response if Israel retaliates.
Meanwhile, Israel's northern border with Lebanon is seeing active fighting today. Israeli troops went into Lebanon and battled with Hezbollah. 8 Israeli soldiers died in that fighting, with other reports counting about a dozen Lebanese deaths, as Israeli bombardment of cities in Lebanon has continued for several days now.
And finally, Gaza, the conflict that has captured so much of the world's attention in the past year. An Israeli raid on the southern city of Khan Yunis killed 51 people and injured dozens more. Red Crescent workers and others carried away people on stretchers. This as Israel tries to eliminate the militant group Hamas from Gaza. That campaign, of course, began nearly a year ago after Hamas launched an attack on Israel that killed 1,200 people and took a few hundred more people as hostages. Since then, an estimated 41,000 people in the Palestinian territory have been killed by Israeli strikes. Join us tomorrow on The World for reporting on what life is like inside Gaza now, a year since this conflict has consumed the region.
In Argentina, many university students and teachers are taking to the streets today in what's expected to be one of the largest protests against President Javier Milei, a free market economist. He was elected last year with the promise of setting the country's dismal economy back on track. Instead, at state universities, students say his austerity measures have wreaked havoc. Michael Fox has a story from the University of Cordoba.
Students and teachers are on strike. Classes are empty, but the halls are busy with activity. Lautaro Alacia is a fifth-year law student who's painting signs for the march. One of them reads, "Without the university, there is no future."
La universidad, como te digo, es un estorbo para él y trata de sacársela de encima.
The university system is a hindrance for President Milei, and he wants to get rid of it, says Alacia. I don't know if he wants to close it today or tomorrow, but his objective is to charge tuition, to make it into a business so that only those who can pay can take classes, he says. Privatizing universities or charging tuition is not on the agenda now, but it's the direction many students fear things may be headed. See, in Argentina, higher education is a right. There are private universities, but 80% of the country's university students study at one of Argentina's roughly 60 federal universities. There, tuition is free. the University of Córdoba, is the oldest. Founded by Jesuits in the early 1600s, it's actually one of the oldest universities in all of Latin America. A group of students walk across the gravel yard of one of the school's most historic colonial buildings. But like federal universities across the country, it has taken a hit this year. Cuts have slashed operating budgets. Inflation has unraveled teachers' salaries. Leticia Medina is a social sciences professor and a leader in a local teachers' union. The value of our salaries has dropped by 40% over the last 8 months, she says. And this is on top of decreasing salaries in recent years. It's making it impossible to continue to research and teach. It's really sad, says chemistry professor Rodrigo Quiroga. We have colleagues who have already left or are looking to either leave the university or leave the country. Congress has been working to fix the problem.
Affirmativos 52, negativos 14, una abstención.
In mid-September, the Argentine Senate approved a university financing law that requires inflation adjustments for teachers' salaries every 2 months and guarantees the university budget into next year. But President Javier Milei has promised to veto the law.
Hoy es un día histórico para nuestro país. Después de décadas de fracasos,
Milei is a libertarian economist who was elected last year with the promise of gutting big government and ending the hyperinflation that has plagued the country. In January, flanked by his most prominent ministers, Milei launched an ambitious reform package which he said would overhaul the Argentine economy. Among those items on the chopping block were university budgets. He's accused universities of indoctrinating students with Marxist ideology and called students and teachers hypocrites, liars, and enemies to the ideas of freedom. But he's denied claims he wants to close public universities. Roughly 40% of the country supports the president, according to a recent poll, including many students.
Milei confirmó que vetará la ley de financiamiento universitario. Ahora,
in this video, a young member of Milei's new libertarian party Freedom Advances explains that it's important for Milei to veto the new law guaranteeing salary increases. If not, she says, inflation will just continue to rise alongside the university budget and the price of items at the supermarket. Camilo Pérez Manrique is the head of the University of Buenos Aires libertarian student group Somos Libres. We are free. He says this week's march isn't really about inflation, finances, or the university budget. This march has clearly political goals with the hopes of undermining and destroying the image of Javier Milei, he says. That's the main objective. But back at the university, students say they are fighting for their school, even many who support Milei. According to a recent poll, more than 80% of Argentines believe their government should increase the budget for retirement, health, and education.
Y en su momento, yo tenía la necesidad de un cambio para el país. Yo no estaba de acuerdo.
Iván Antinori is a 20-year-old third-year psychology student from the Argentine countryside. He says he voted for Milei because he believes the country needed a change. But if it wasn't for the federal university system, he wouldn't be able to study. That's because most Argentines don't have the means to pay for higher education. According to a new study, since Milei came to office, 3 million more people fell into poverty. More than 50% of Argentines live below the poverty line. Students say the free federal university system is a lifeline.
Yo no podría pagar un departamento y a la par una universidad.
I wouldn't be able to pay for rent and at the same time university fees, says Antinori, who works part-time. And I think that many Argentines are in a similar situation, he says. That's why we take it upon ourselves to defend the public university. The strikes and protests can take a toll on the school year, but students say they're also just a part of university life in Argentina. It's part of our DNA, says law student Lautaro Alasia. It's part of the story of our university, and we know that many others fought before us so that we can be here today. That opinion is not universal, but it's widespread, and it's clear that most students and teachers will not be sitting this march out. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Córdoba, Argentina.
Late last week, China made an important financial decision. It introduced a massive stimulus package into its banking system. The Chinese government also announced that other measures would be introduced this week to boost the economy. It marks a significant policy change for Beijing at a time when China's economy is struggling big time. Isabel Hilton is a founder of the China Dialogue Trust in London.
The economy has been struggling for a while. We're well past the era of double-digit growth, which China enjoyed for nearly 30 years, but that phase is over. It has a lot of distortions in the economy, and really the thing that really drove the spectacular growth in the past decades, which was property development, is now a drag on the economy. It had too big a place in the stimulus, and when it went bad, it left the Chinese economy with enormous amounts of debt. It left households with their life savings diminishing. It left people unemployed, and it left an economy that can't quite find how to grow. So that really is the collection of problems that the government is trying to resolve with these packages.
What's interesting, Isabel, is that the government in Beijing seemed to be against stimulus packages up till now. Why was that, and why did they end up shifting their position?
Well, indeed, they were against stimulus packages, and I think that it's partly hubris. They felt that it had a successful economy. You know, they set a relatively low growth target this year, but they're only just going to make it, really by the skin of their teeth. And in the Chinese political system, not meeting your targets is really not very good. So it would have been a very bad look for the government. Now, one of the difficulties that they're having with the industrial policy, problem is that China's more advanced industrial products are coming onto a global market with big subsidies, and they're meeting resistance. They're meeting resistance in the United States with big tariffs. They're also meeting resistance in the European Union, which is the biggest market. And they're beginning to meet resistance in emerging economies who are also trying to build up their industrial sectors. So it's not clear that investment is going to pay off unless the domestic market really takes hold.
Isabel, have you been able to glean any public reaction in China to this economic jumpstart by the government?
There's been a certain amount of positive chatter on social media. The most visible effect is that the stock market had its best day for a very long time. It's still below its pre-COVID levels, and there's a certain amount of skepticism about the Chinese stock market. You know, the average investor doesn't have a lot of faith in the stock market, which is partly why they put their money into property in such very large numbers. So I think that people are encouraged to some extent that the government appears to be doing something about the economy. But I think that people are still relatively cautious.
Is there hope in Beijing that economic stimulus could coax more international business back to China after some enterprises reduce their exposure or just quit the country altogether?
I think that's a hope. I'm not sure that it's going to have much effect, because I think there are a number of other issues that are affecting the willingness of foreign investors to go into China. One thing is that for all the growth that there still is in the Chinese economy, it tends to be favoring domestic brands rather than foreign brands. So if you look, for example, at what's happening to foreign cars in China these days, they have done very well, particularly the Germans, and they're losing market share, as is Tesla. So they're losing them to domestic brands. So there's a bit of the nationalist mood is also affecting the way people spend their money. And I think also foreign investors have become a little wary of government action, because the government has attacked various parts of the economy with very severe measures.
What do you think the medium to long-term effects will be for China as the stimulus comes into effect?
You know, if it's followed through, then it ought to be positive. Building up China's domestic consumption would clearly be a good thing for the Chinese economy overall. It would lessen global tensions. It would also feed back into very positive innovation, which is going on in China. It's not clear how far it's going to go. The state absorbs a great deal of the national income in rather opaque ways, as does the party. I mean, I think that if they did follow through, if they did maintain this, then it would have a positive effect.
Isabel Hilton is a founder of the China Dialogue Trust in London.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. In Turkey, there's a place known as the Meyhane. It's a kind of cafe bar where you go when you've got feelings to let out and want other patrons to fully support you. You can usually order small dishes with fish and a strong anise-flavored liqueur there. Mostly, though, these neighborhood fixtures are meant for celebrating the best of times and seeking comfort in the worst of times. The World's Duri Buscarin first brought us this story from Istanbul 2 years ago.
As you duck inside, the warm air of a meyhane feels like a hug. The smell of fried calamari drifts over from a nearby table as music from old Turkish movies plays. It's just before the dinner rush at Güneşin Sofrası, a meyhane that takes its name from a phrase in Turkish poetry, meaning table of the sun.
But sofra in Turkish is not only the table. Sofra also means the place where the people come together.
Aslı Yalıgöz is the proprietor here. At Güneşin Sofrası, she wanted to invoke an old-timey social club where Turkish secularists once gathered to discuss politics late into the night.
Everybody knows that there are some people like you here, very similar people. So they feel that I'm not alone. I'm in the family, I'm between friends.
And when you're sitting between friends, often for hours, and especially after a couple of drinks, emotions run high. It's not unusual for Yalıgöz to spot a guest start to cry.
It's very normal. It's very ordinary. If you can see so many people cries or laughs or sings.
If someone tears up, she keeps an eye on them for a few minutes and makes sure their friends are comforting them properly.
Everybody knows that this is a public place, but also you can feel your privacy. Maybe this is meyhane.
When you go into meyhane, it's like going to a therapist.
Begüm Babuşçu is a clinical psychologist and a self-described meyhane enthusiast. She says that in Turkish culture, it's not common to speak about your problems explicitly or directly. The meyhane lets you ease into difficult conversations.
When you go to meyhanes, you're not expected to drink fast and you're not expected to eat fast. It's actually considered inappropriate. So you drink slowly and you eat slowly, step by step. You go into deeper topics, you go into deeper emotions.
With the understanding that everything said at the meyhane table is said in confidence. It's these factors, Babuşçu says, that make the meyhane a place where people feel comfortable letting tears fall, especially men.
So it's not shamed, but it's rather listened.
Maybe it's this acceptance that makes people cry, and the raka probably has something to do with it. That's an anise-flavored liqueur that turns milky white when you add an ice cube and a dash of water. By 9 p.m., the Güneşin Sofrası Meyhane is packed. Atil Taşpınar sits with a group of old friends, all retired professional basketball players, to share old memories over plates of eggplant salad, white cheese, and fresh fish.
Çünkü buradaki ortam daha sıcak.
A meyhane isn't fancy, he says. It's warm. You don't have to compete for status or anything.
Biliyorsunuz, sevinçler paylaştıkça artıyor, dertler paylaştıkça azalıyor.
When you're happy in a meyhane, your joy increases, he says. It's shared. And when you're sad, your sadness is lessened too. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
The never-ending search for love. Increasingly, it's happening online. A new app in Somalia is designed to help singles not just meet each other, but to then take it to the next level. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
In 2016, community elders and religious leaders in Somalia established the Guriyasamo Center for Family Development with the aim of helping to strengthen and develop traditional family values in a nation that's been fractured by civil war and conflict. In 2022, they decided to tackle a very specific problem, helping young people get married. I spoke with Abdinasser Omar Abdullah, the center's director, over the phone.
We have seen that it is important to find a place for single people to find the person they wanted to share their life with. So we decided to make a special app for single people, and it is called Kurdon app.
He says the Gurdon app is the first of its kind in Somalia and that it's a type of technology community leaders should embrace.
We would like our Somali community to be in line with modern countries.
He points out how, of course, there are many similar apps around the world these days. Hinge and Tinder come to my mind as some of the most well-known. Those apps cater to a diverse variety of relationships that people might be looking for. But Gurdon isn't like that. Abdullah says he expects only people who are serious about marriage to use the app. After all, Gurdon means seeking marriage in Somali. Men can only see women's profiles and vice versa.
In accordance with the Islamic religion and the good culture now in Somalia, it is only used by Somali people wherever they are.
To use the app, you create a profile and select whether you are seeking someone who is single, has a family, or has been married before. You're also required to write down your weight, height, and skin color. Hassan Omar Abdi is a 24-year-old in Mogadishu. Abdi says he began trying out the app after he had graduated from university and was looking for a way to kill time. Eventually, he met a girl on the app who he was attracted to. They began chatting with each other for about a year and then decided to get married. A lot of Somalis are using this application, both at home and in the diaspora, he says. Abdullah, the director of the family center that created Gurdon, is convinced it will also help those who struggle with dating.
Helps people who are short-tempered or shy about dating, and also helps people who are ready for marriage, who they don't want to waste too much time.
Idil Mohammed Osman is a 21-year-old in Mogadishu. She heard about the app from a girl in her neighborhood and decided to give it a try. She said she doesn't like the fact that you have to pay a dollar to match with people. In her opinion, most young Somalis don't need the extra help in dating. She says in general, they're very open and social people. She says, though, that the app has been useful for making non-romantic relationships, especially with people in the diaspora. Gurdon's creators certainly did not have friendship in mind when creating this app, but if it's a byproduct, is that such a bad thing? Now, there are several other online options for Somalis looking for love and marriage. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Nairobi.
You're listening to The World.
Ukraine wants permission to hit Russia where it hurts. Western allies fear that would escalate the war.
Russia can attack us and our civilians, and this doesn't escalate the situation. But we cannot, because we will escalate the situation. This is just stupid.
And an Indian singer reflects on making a splash at the Coachella Music Festival. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. The first week of October is historically when kids begin a new school year in Haiti. Fresh starts are hard to come by on the island these days, though. Gang violence and hunger make daily life a struggle, especially for children. That's despite the arrival this summer of hundreds of UN-backed Kenyan security forces. The Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles has been traveling to Haiti for more than a decade and was recently there again. I asked her whether Haitian children are returning to the classrooms.
Well, you know, it's very difficult for a lot of kids because they have been displaced. They and their parents have been forced out of their homes by armed gangs. The number is now more than 700,000 Haitians are essentially homeless. Many of them are living in encampments. Some of those encampments are on the grounds of schools. So this week, there are also a number of schools in the capital and elsewhere that have not been able to open because they're being occupied by the homeless.
Wow. You went to a school in Jacmel, a city in southern Haiti, where a lot of people have fled from Port-au-Prince. What is it like there for kids?
This is a seaside town. They are fighting very hard not to get the kind of camps that we have seen in Port-au-Prince. They're looking at between 500 and 600 vacancies. At least 260 of them are teachers that they don't have because they've migrated or they've retired or, you know, they've died. At the same time, the parents, they don't have the money. Even at a school that is supposed to be free because it's a government-operated school, well, they still need money for uniforms. They need money for fees. They need money for books. They need money for transportation. So imagine, because of this gang violence, people have been forced from their homes, forced from their jobs, if they had a job, and people are just really scrounging. But yet, education is the one thing that parents really, truly still believe in. And so they make enormous sacrifices. I mean, this is a country whose economy has been completely shot because of its violence.
So aside from education and kids trying to go back to school this week, what was your overall impression of the security system in the capital and elsewhere on the island?
The reality is that there are 410 foreign police officers on the ground, mostly Kenyan police officers. They are trying to help the Haitian police restore security, but they are struggling. You still have a town just outside of Port-au-Prince called Gantier that is completely under gang control. It fell under gang control after the presence of this foreign force. The town next door, which is closer to the border, Fonparisien, they are holding on as best as they can not to be overtaken by gangs. When I went to Léogâne, I have to tell you the situation for me was worse than the 2010 earthquake. You have more than 40,000 people in just a few months who have been forced from their homes from the town next door. These are people who are homeowners who had jobs, and today they are literally sleeping in the mud. They just feel stuck. At least with the 2010 earthquake, they saw NGOs, they heard people speak about a better tomorrow, and they're not hearing that. And when you look at the numbers, you know, this week Haiti passed a grim milestone, 5.4 million people that are facing hunger. And yet the country cannot get the attention of the world to raise the money that it needs.
The UN-backed Kenyan troops that you were talking about were hoping when they arrived to secure Haiti's seaport. But gangs are once again attacking the port, including, I understand, crane operators there. What is the current situation?
So we're now looking at 3 weeks where the port has been closed. The most recent incident is a crane operator who was shot. Boats, you know, these shipping lines, a lot of them coming from Miami, they've basically put any shipments to Haiti on hold. We do have the police and the Kenyan force on the ground. They are starting to destroy some homes so they can get better visibility, or they're trying to better secure the ports. But the shipping line saying, hey, we need some security here.
We've spoken about the UN-backed Kenyan troops. I also wanted to ask you about the new acting prime minister, Gerry Kony, who was sworn into office in August. Has his appointment made a difference in terms of security on the ground?
You know, the biggest challenge to the security right now is having the funding. This is a force that is supposed to have 2,500 security personnel. And again, it has 410. The United States remains the largest funder of this force with over $300 million, but that is still not enough. This week, what we saw, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to extend the lifeline of this force for another year. But at the same time, we saw the United States abandon the push for now to have this force upgraded into a UN peacekeeping mission, which would basically give it some guaranteed funding.
Finally, Jacqueline, when you were in Haiti, did anyone you spoke to in recent days mention the plight of Haitians in Springfield, Ohio? There have been the conspiracy theories about pets being eaten there that has become a topic in the U.S. presidential contest. Were folks on the ground you were talking to talking about that when you were in Haiti?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, what we saw last week was that the president of the Presidential Security Council, that's the ruling presidential body in Haiti, Edgar Leblanc, when he appeared before the United Nations General Assembly in his high-level address, he spoke about this. And he basically showed solidarity with the people of Springfield, Ohio. Haitians very much have been seized by these unfounded accusations that have been, you know, made their way into U.S. presidential elections.
The Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles.
Germany has some of the world's strongest animal welfare laws. Protecting animals is actually written into the country's constitution. But as a bill makes its way through parliament to make those laws even stronger, people in Germany can't agree on what animal welfare means and which animals need to be protected. At the center of it all is the country's beloved sausage dog, the Dachshund. Valerie Hamilton has more from the southern German city of Regensburg.
Germany doesn't have a national animal, but if it did, it might well be the dachshund, which Germans call the Dackel. You see Dackel silhouettes all over Germany-themed swag, from T-shirts to coffee mugs. Not that many Germans actually own Dackels, but when they do, they go all in. 1,100 of them showed up for an annual dachshund parade organized by Regensburg's Dachshund Museum.
My grandparents had dachshund, my uncles, my parents. We have two. My sister has one, my brother has one. We are a whole Dackel family.
Annabelle Schultes told her future husband Frank, no Dackel, no dice. Their Dackel Paul, now 14, was their wedding present. So for her, a provision in Germany's animal welfare law that could limit breeding of Dackels? That's personal.
My heart would break.
If you're not familiar with Dackels, dachshunds, they're really long and also really short. That's the problem. Their extra long backs and extra short legs can cause slipped discs and back pain. The new law would ban what it calls torture breeding, not just of Dackels with bad backs, but shepherds with bad hips, bulldogs with breathing problems. As a policy debate, it may sound niche, but it's hit a nerve. This is Tatjana Euler, who came to Regensburg with her Dackels, Streusel, Paulina, and Twinkie.
And I was never into politics, okay? But when I see what they do right now, they should better shut up.
It's not just this torture breeding of dogs. The law has a lot of new rules meant to protect all kinds of animals. Annabelle Schultes thinks that while her Dackels don't need a new law, other animals do.
Pigs and cows, they are living a hard time sometimes. It has to change. It has to be better for them.
Schau mal, hier geht's ja die Tiere jetzt schlecht.
Hans Steiner doesn't have a Dackel, but he does have 71 milk cows. As they wander freely around his breezy, quiet dairy barn in the foothills of the Alps, he thinks they have it pretty good. Or at least better than the 1 million cows in Germany that are tied to one spot for most or all of their lives. The law would end that, along with other practices like cutting off baby pigs' tails. But farmers say the rules will drive them out of business. 20,000 of them signed a petition to stop it.
Tierwohl, Tierwohl.
Steiner says farmers care about their animals too, but the law is tackling suffering that only exists in people's heads. He shows me a calf standing quietly in a cage with green dabs of disinfectant where his horns used to be. Farmers burn out the horns so they don't get speared. Steiner dehorned this one himself 2 hours ago. Under the proposed law, he would have had to call and pay a vet. But he's fine, Steiner says. Look at him. Steiner says farmers know best how to care for their animals, and the government should mind its own business. Except, he says, for torture breeding of dogs. That has to end.
Everybody agrees that, you know, it's important to protect animals from unnecessary harm. But what that specifically means is very, very much contested.
Marcel Sebastian is a sociologist studying human-animal relations. In Germany, he says, they're complicated. Livestock farming is big business, but Germans are cutting back on meat and dairy as they reconsider using animals for food. Add to that, the new law is sponsored by Germany's Green Party, whose agriculture minister is a vegetarian, by the way. And you get, not a culture war, says Sebastian, but something messier.
I recently watched a debate from the parliament, and literally every politician started their talk with saying, of course, animal welfare is very important. And then the but came.
And the debate marches on. A few days before the Dackel parade, the animal rights organization PETA called on authorities to shut it down, saying the noise and stress would make the dogs' suffering worse. Instead, thousands of people and their dogs turned out in what amounts to, if not a protest march, a kind of show of force. With 1,175 officially registered Dackels, the parade set a world record. The head of the country's Dackel Club told a German newspaper, if the law tries to mess with their dogs, they'll set another one, this time outside the parliament in Berlin. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Regensburg, Germany.
And And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
A town on Argentina's Atlantic coast has been invaded by parrots. Thousands of the green, yellow, and red birds have descended on Hilario Ascasubi. Driven there by deforestation in the surrounding hills, the parrots are chewing on electric cables and driving residents nuts with their incessant screeching and inescapable poop.
In southwestern Japan today, a 500-pound American bomb from World War II suddenly detonated on the taxiway at the Miyazaki Airport. Thankfully, there were no injuries, but the explosion did produce a large crater and more than 80 flights were canceled.
And finally, a 29-year-old man is deep into a 10,000-mile hike from his native Egypt to Japan. Omar Nock is now TikTok famous for his travel dispatches. He's making the trek using only trains, cargo ships, hitchhiking, horseback, the occasional camel, and his 2 feet.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
Western leaders are making a consequential decision about the war in Ukraine, whether or not Ukraine can use long-range weapons supplied by the West to strike inside Russia. The debate has played out for months. Journalist Volodymyr Solohub is based in Ukraine and has been getting a sense of Ukrainian public opinion on all of this. He spoke with The World's Carol Hills.
This is the line that the Western allies have not crossed. They've given weapons for defense purposes with the stipulation that they cannot be used for attacks. So to do what Zelensky is suggesting, that would be a real turning point, wouldn't it?
Yes, Carol, that would. And Ukrainians here, they have seen these so-called turning points quite a lot. At first, these were Western artillery systems that nobody wanted to give Ukraine. And in the end, Ukraine did receive those. Then these were tanks, U.S. Abrams. Ukraine eventually received those. Then F-16s, American fighter jets. Everybody thought that would be a turning point. Now Ukraine has them and nothing much has changed. So eventually, what the feeling here in Kyiv is, in the government circles and political circles, that eventually the Ukraine's Western partners will cave in. They will allow Ukraine to use long-range weapons to fire deep inside Russia. But at the same time, during these back and forth, a lot of valuable time will be lost.
Now, you talked to some Ukrainians about all of this. I know you found an English teacher, Yelena, from Kyiv. She was blunt about the West so far prohibiting Ukraine's use of long-range weapons.
I feel that it's absolutely unfair, and they just do not allow us to protect our cities, and this is just unfair. So they are helping us, but they are not allowing us to use their help, and this is just stupid.
Well, that's the concern of the partners, that this permission will escalate, you know, even further. Are you concerned there may be even more escalation?
No, because we are already at war, so what further escalation are we talking about?
People have been living, you know, in the state of war for the last 10 years and in the state of full-scale invasion for the last 2.5 years. Things that for people living somewhere in Europe or in the U.S. Would sound strange are, you know, very daily routine for many Ukrainians, like the air raid alarms when there is a threat of ballistic missile hits or kamikaze drones hits on major metropolitan areas. You know, Ukraine's Western partners are helping Ukraine, but they feel that this help is not enough.
You also talked to an 18-year-old woman, Kira, and her mother. They left the Donbas in eastern Ukraine in 2014 when Russia first invaded. They took issue with the prohibition on using long-range weapons to strike Russia, saying it's unrealistic.
There is only war only in our country, but war is between two countries. And it's unfair, to be honest, to our people and to our country.
Volodymyr, is this idea of unfairness, is it prevalent?
A lot of Ukrainians think that Russians should be feeling the effects of war just as much as Ukrainians are feeling it. They want missiles to be flying into Russian territory. They want weapons depots to be exploding. They want Russians not to feel safe the same way millions of Ukrainians have not been feeling safe for the last 2.5 years.
Hmm. You also encountered a deep cynicism, which really comes across in your conversation with a doctor named Yaroslav.
I think that our foreign partners don't want Ukraine to win the war. they want the war to continue a long, long time because they have own financial interests, own financial investment into the war. They factories, military factories, get more money.
Now he trails off there. But what do you make of his point of view? I mean, where do you think that's coming from?
They're seeing that Ukrainian government is constantly asking for more weapons, for more support from their Western allies. And the Western allies are very hesitant to provide this support or these weapons all at once. And that's where these cynical thoughts are coming from, that maybe Ukraine's Western partners are not that willing to allow Ukraine to win that fast.
President Volodymyr Zelensky just spent a week in the U.S. making the case for more support. What is your sense of public opinion of Zelensky now, nearly 3 years into this war?
President Zelensky still enjoys overwhelming support here in Ukraine. But of course, as the war drags on into its third year, there are more and more opinions that perhaps Zelensky could have done more to finally end this war as soon as possible.
Journalist Volodymyr Solohub in Kyiv, speaking with the world's Carol Hills.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Coachella, my name is Sid Sriram.
At Coachella this year, the audience heard a sound you don't find at a lot of pop music festivals. Classical Carnatic music from South India. Today on Movement, our series about music and migration, Maclete Hedero speaks with Indian-American singer Sid Sriram about how he found his voice and unique sound.
Sid, you said you grew up in Fremont. Is this your childhood bedroom?
Yeah, it is very much so.
Did you take down the posters?
There's a couple that are still there. Like, there's like one, that there's a clock. I don't know if you can see it. It's like a crayon clock. It's definitely still the exact same one.
What are your musical memories in that room?
A whole lot. I was born in India, in Chennai, in 1990, and then we moved here in 91. Mm-hmm. And like a year after we moved to the States, my mom started her Carnatic music school, South Indian classical like vocal music school. So this room is probably a lot of me just like not wanting to practice, or you know what I mean?
It was also the room where Sid encountered his other great musical love, soul music.
Stevie Wonder, Donny Hathaway, Aretha. Like, I was like 8 years old, 7 years old, just like flipping through Jazz 91.1.
It would take a long time for those two strands of his musical background to fully come together. I believe Jehovah. As a college student, Sid started posting songs on YouTube, mostly covers.
And at that time, it would be write a song that felt like it was grounded in like R&B soul, and then open up a section near the end where I just like it'd be the Indian part, you know? Mm. And at the time, that was what I was able to do and just kind of comprehend and put forth.
At that time, Sid was actively chasing fame in the U.S. music industry, meeting with record labels, posting videos, working whatever angle he had. But that's not where his big break would come from.
In 2010, I sent a cold email to A.R. Rahman.
A.R. Rahman is a legend of Indian film music.
He was my hero growing up. So I sent him an email when I was in college with some of my music that I was releasing at the time, just with no expectations. And he responded a couple weeks later. And that led to me recording with him in 2012, right before I graduated.
In that first session, Rahman asked him to sing an original R&B song, then asked him to sing some Carnatic music, testing the range of his abilities. Clearly, Rahman liked what he heard, because a few months later, he asked Sid to record his first big film song, Adiye.
So right after I graduated, that song released and it kind of jump-started my career over there. And once that happened, my dad started managing me and I started spending around 6 to 8 months out the year in Chennai. So it kind of became home. And I admittedly was reluctant to go start doing this kind of 6 to 8 month thing over there because I was still hell-bent on my career taking off in the U.S.
Wait, do you mean that you were reluctant to, like, move there permanently? Or you were reluctant to even be there for the 6 to 8 months
I was reluctant even for the... Because up until that point, I limited and constrained my relationship with the country and my city over there. I was like, okay, do 2 months, come back to regular life. That's just like an excursion for a little bit.
Sid was still focused on being an American pop star. That felt like the industry and audience that mattered in the end. So why spend half the year in a different country, working in a different industry, reaching a different audience?
And in retrospect, thinking about it, there was just a decent amount of just like, you know, self-hate packed into all that and just like, oh, I don't want to live there. Like, this is my life over here. But once I went there is when I really embraced who I was and stopped relegating my Indianness to this very specific sliver of like time. And it changed everything.
That first year in Chennai, Sid found a new daily routine. It started with waking up at 6 every morning to go for a run on the beach near his house.
That directly followed up by like vocal exercises and coffee.
He recommitted himself to his Carnatic music practice, finding focus in that daily discipline.
And I'd never done that before. I would kind of just like let the day happen.
And Sid was definitely not just letting the day happen. He was what's called a playback singer in the most productive film industry in the world.
So how many songs have you recorded for Indian films?
Like hundreds. There's a lot.
And ironically, it was the time he spent in India that ultimately allowed Sid to find his voice back in the U.S. In 2020, he began writing the songs that would become his latest album, Siddharth. And you hear in them the confidence and sense of self, the wholeness.
Like, there's these places in the album where you're in, like, a soul run, and then, like, a split second later, like, not even a second later, you're in a Carnatic run.
Yeah.
I just want to know, what does that feel like, in your body?
I really just kind of like feel like water, you know?
Wow.
And that I think like it, there's just such a fluidity in it that is very freeing. And I remember the jam sessions we were having. It was for Dear Sahana. And that was the first time where I sang a phrase that did that shift like mid riff. We fall from grace. And I knew, I was like, oh, there's the thing. Like, that's what it was. And it happened without, like, thinking or anything. It just kind of flowed out of me. You know, it almost felt like a rebirth of sorts in terms of just... it was the first time that I was really able to understand and celebrate, like, soul music and Carnatic music in one breath.
That's Sid Sriram singing Dear Sahana from his album Siddharth. For more stories at the crossroads of music and migration, search for Movement with Macleod Hedero wherever you listen to podcasts. The series is produced by Ian Koss and Macleod and supported by the Mellon Foundation.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org, by the Ford Foundation, by the Henry Luce Foundation, by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Patchwork Collective, Lillian and Ed Schneider, the Gruber Family Foundation, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Helen and Russell Pine. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.